Hello and welcome to the NJA podcast. My name is Kate Swanell and I am your host. This week we are talking about venous thromboembolism. I might say this is my second attempt at recording this intro as the first one for the entire time I said venous embothrombolism. But I digress. For the first time, Australasian guidelines for the diagnosis and management of VTE, there you go, I avoided it, have been developed. A summary of those guidelines is published today by the NJA. Associate Professor Hewan Tran is the head of the Hemostasis and Thrombosis Unit at Alfred Health, and he's lead author of the guideline summary. He's also my special guest today.
Venous thromboembolism equals deep vein thrombosis and pulmonary embolism, and it is essentially blood clots in the venous circulation. They're the two main types of venous thrombosis, and in addition, you can get venous thrombosis in rarer venous circulation. Splanchnic circulation, which is in the abdomen, and sometimes we see central cerebral sinus thrombosis as well, which is in the head.
What's the incidence of VTE in Australia at the moment?
So across the board, the incidence is about 1 in 5, 1 in 10,000 if you're under the age of 40. And then at that juncture, the incidence starts to increase gradually to the point where you're 80, it is 1 in 100.
So your lifetime risk is what?
8 in 1,000, roughly.
Okay. Yeah. So these guidelines that you and your group have written, what's different about them from the way things have been managed so far?
I think the main purpose of the guideline was just to really standardise the practice. And there's unfortunately been such document before in the Asia Pacific region. And also in the last, I would say, at least 15 years, there's been a huge revolution in the treatment of venous thrombosis.
And is that the novel anticoagulants, the oral?
So we used to call it the novel oral anticoagulant, but it's no longer novel. So I pushed the term direct oral anticoagulant because it's targeted therapy. And, you know, there's huge practical advantage because it can now be administered orally and much more conveniently because in years gone by, when I was much younger and getting into the area, you know, back in the 1980s and 1990s, everyone had to be in hospital for an intravenous infusion of heparin. And then we had to cross over to warfarin, which is a real pain because of its challenging pharmacological properties. And then, you know, we had low molecular weight heparin, which took away the infusion, but you still left with the long-term treatment only with warfarin, which is the only oral anticoagulant which we had for at least 60 years. It required regular monitoring because of the food and drug interaction, and it was a real practical challenge for patients and clinician, because probably about a third of patients, regardless of what you try to do in terms of correcting their diet and managing the medication, their control, their time in target therapeutic range was poor.
And I imagine compliance was worse than it is now too.
Yeah, compliance was always a challenge, but the conversely, though, you know whether there was a compliance issue because you could measure a number.
So what are the risk factors for VTE?
So the traditional risk factors are surgery. So major surgery, you know, anything that lasts more than 45 minutes in my mind, although my other colleagues want to push to 30 minutes. That's a bit aggressive. The other thing is major trauma. The Alfred Hospital being one of the state major trauma hospital, people fracture their limbs, their pelvis as a result of motor vehicle accidents, and there's a high rate of venous thrombosis in that group of patients. And then the last one, well, not the last one, is the immobility. So if you're very immobilized and you have an acute medical illness, for example, if you have heart failure, pneumonia, then that's also a risk factor. pregnancy can be seen as one as well. And then the other one, which really falls into the realm of hematologists, is really changes within the constituent of the blood. But, you know, but you don't really see that. That's nothing that you can do about really once you've developed, once you've been diagnosed with the problem. And really that's a workup with our hematology team.
I know there's a difference between provoked VTE and unprovoked. What's the clinical difference there?
We like to think of it as three different groups. So there's the provoked by major surgery or major trauma. And then at the other end of the spectrum, we have the unprovoked in the absence of surgery, trauma and significant immobility. And then there's a group in between, which is not provoked by major surgery or major trauma, or partially provoked is some people try to call it.
Yeah.
And the reason for classifying that is that the risk of recurrence is different for each of them. So if you've had a blood clot, a DVT or PE on the back of major surgery, for example, hip and knee replacement, then, you know, you get treated for 3 months and you stop. And the risk of recurrence beyond that is low. It's less than 1% in the first, 1 year. So they don't need to have extended anticoagulation. At the other end of the spectrum, if you have unprovoked venous thrombosis, then the risk of recurrence in the first 12 months after stopping ranges from about 8 to 10%, and that's recurrently produced in many studies. Cumulatively, over the five-year period after stopping, that risk is about 30 to 40%. So those patients, there's a very strong case for them to remain on extended anticoagulation. And then that group in between that we talked about, the partially or the non-majorly provoked, such as, you know, if you're have an arthroscopy that takes 15 minutes and you get a blood clot, or if you're on an aeroplane, which itself is a minor risk factor, then there's what we call equipoise. And then we need to have a good discussion with the patient about the pros and cons of stopping versus continuing. And the benefit now of having these direct oral anticoagulant, where it's much more predictable in their pharmacological properties and the rates of bleeding that we saw in the clinical trials was much lower, there's a greater tendency, if you like, for the patients to lean towards remaining on extended anticoagulation.
Now, one of the things that caught my eye, particularly about unprovoked VTE, was a possible link with future malignancies.
What's
the mechanism at work there?
So malignancy is probably one of the most thrombogenic condition, and it's really to do, I think, with within the constituents of the blood, and that's probably the key thing in simple terms. And we do see that patients who are aging and who have an unprovoked episode of venous thrombosis, you know, it's important that we take a thorough history and examination and follow up with the appropriate investigation, because the subsequent diagnosis of a malignancy in the subsequent 12 months after the diagnostic episode of VT is about 5 to 10%.
I'm chatting today with Associate Professor Huynh Tran, who is the boss of the WASH at the Hemostasis and Thrombosis Unit at Alfred Health in Melbourne. The full version of the VTE Diagnosis and Management Guidelines can be found at the Thrombosis and Hemostasis Society of Australia and New Zealand's website. That's www.thanz.org.au/resources/THANZ-guidelines. And, of course, you can find the guideline summary at www.mja.com.au. Back to our chat. So how does VTE present?
So with deep vein thrombosis, the symptoms can be very nonspecific. So patients will just have a sore leg, either in the calf or in the thigh or behind the knee or in front of the knee. This is often accompanied by some sort of swelling. They can get redness and they get unusual symptoms. That coupled with risk factors requires imaging with ultrasonography to either confirm or rule out. But often before that, you know, if we want to be scientific, we can actually do a blood test and in combination with the clinical prediction score. So if your clinical prediction score is low and your blood test is negative, then you don't need to have an ultrasound. Now, if we're talking about pulmonary embolism, then obviously that's a much more serious condition. Yeah. And patients will get shortness of breath, chest pain. Sometimes they cough up blood. They can have dizziness if it's very big. And again, you know, any if you can't breathe, if you've got chest pain,
you're going to fall over.
You need to go and see a doctor.
Is there any imaging method that's best?
So for deep vein thrombosis, it's ultrasonography, the current standard of care. For pulmonary embolism, the options are either CT pulmonary angiogram, or the other one is ventilation and perfusion lung scanning. Perfusion lung scanning, there's a bit of an art to it, but it's generally associated with less radiation. And often that's the modality that we prefer, you know, in pregnant women.
Yes.
And also with CTPA, or CT pulmonary angiogram, there is contrast and, you know, there is a risk of kidney injury as well.
Okay, so for people with renal failure, that's probably not the go.
No, absolutely. So they all divert to a VQ scan.
You mentioned briefly earlier about the duration of anticoagulation. What do the guidelines have to say about that?
Yeah, so everyone with an acute episode of proximal DVT, so that's an important point. Proximal DVT means that it involves the popliteal vein and more proximally, or if they have a pulmonary embolism, then they should be on anticoagulation for at least 3 months. So we generally say 3 to 6 months because the risk of recurrence after that is very similar. So there's a window. And then usually at around the 3 months mark, we talk to the patient or even before then and try to categorize them into those three groups that we discussed about earlier, and then counsel them about stopping or continuing the pros and cons. And also if they are in that middle equipoise group, then, you know, we do consider their patient preference as well.
And it sounds like it is the type of anticoags and the length of it that are the key things to a successful outcome.
Yes. So these days, I think the first go-to drug, if you had a proximal DVT and a PE, you know, the easy treatment, provided you have normal renal function and liver function and so on, you know, you can be prescribed one of the direct oral anticoagulant. You know, that's available on the PBS, and, you know, either rivaroxaban or apixaban. It's easy to use because they're oral tablets. Now, there are some tricks to it in terms of dose changing, and that probably needs oversight with the medical staff because, for example, rivaroxaban is a 15 milligram twice a day dosing for 3 weeks. Yep. And then at that juncture, we de-escalate to 20 milligrams once a day. And if we're talking about apixaban, then, you know, it's 10 milligrams for 1 week, 7 days, and then we de-escalate to 5 milligrams twice a day.
You don't put dabigatran on your first line there?
So dabigatran is available in New Zealand. That's reimbursed. But dabigatran in Australia is not reimbursed on the PBS for the indication of venous thrombosis.
Ah.
And in addition, when we did the studies with dabigatran, everyone had to have at least 5 days of low molecular weight heparin. So that sort of takes away the, you know, the novelty.
Thrombolytic agents, when's appropriate for them as opposed to the anticoagulants?
Strictly speaking, for massive pulmonary embolism.
Yeah.
So we're talking about these are huge ones. They really obstruct the central pulmonary vasculature. And often patients are hemodynamically unstable and have collapsed. And that's when that's an undisputable reason for thrombolytic therapy. If you have just you're hemodynamically stable with a pulmonary embolism, then thrombolytic therapy is not indicated. There is a subgroup what we call submassive PE, and there's a bit of argy-bargy controversy about who should be receiving thrombolytic therapy. My own personal view is that if they are stable, they shouldn't be thrombolyzed because the risk of bleeding with thrombolytic therapy is not inconsequential. So you can potentially do harm. Yeah.
Is there a message for GPs in this, Hewan, in terms of the way they should be approaching a patient they suspect has a VTE of some kind?
Yeah, so when you see a patient with those symptoms that we've discussed about for DVT and PE, if they have risk factors, think about the diagnosis and get the appropriate imaging. Once the diagnosis is confirmed, talk to the specialist in the area who's interested and get them started on anticoagulation. Some will require hospital presentation and further evaluation. But in the longer term beyond that, they do need to go back to see someone who's an expert or interested in this disease, because they do need counselling about the duration of anticoagulation. And then if they do come off, there's the issue of thromboprophylaxis during high-risk periods thereafter, because we do see that VTE is a preventable death in hospital. In fact, 5,000 people die of PE in hospital per year in Australia. And in October last year, the national standard for VTE prevention in hospital was launched with the Australian Commission on Safety and Quality in Healthcare. Yep. So that's important. And also the other issue, if they're young and there's a family history, they need counselling, and also some, not all, may or may not benefit from thrombophilia testing. I hope that the guidelines will standardise care.
Yes, and they're available on the Society's website, aren't they?
Yes, they are right now, the slightly longer version.
Yep. Thanks for your time, Hewan.
Not at all. Talk to you soon.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.